to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yana. We're going to turn to the passage that we were considering yesterday. It reads that Yahweh became very angry against Israel because they did not trust in God and they did not rely on his salvation. And yet he had opened the door to heaven for them. We were considering this passage because of Shamayim. It's one of the seven words that God uses in his opening salvo. What we wanted to come to understand is that Shamayim is invocative of the spiritual home of God. It's the place where those who embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant will spend their eternity. And God is saying here that it has a door. Yahusha would speak of that door, as would Yahweh, also in the Torah, explaining that the door to eternal life is Passover. And so if you observe Passover and understand what it represents, which is the doorway to heaven, it is the portal to eternal life, then you can benefit from this gift. But to benefit, you have to know what it represents. Now, it's interesting, of course, in Christianity that they focus on their God's death on a cross. Now, there is no cross in Scripture, and God cannot die. But nonetheless, they focus on their God's death and then subsequent bodily resurrection, which did not occur. All you have to do is read the eyewitness accounts, and you'll find that all four eyewitnesses all four stories relative to what happened on Bikurim show that no one recognized him, which means that his existing body did not rematerialize. It was not reanimated. No one recognized him. That's the only common thread between all of those stories. And so what you have here, if Pauline Christianity is believed, if the death of God on a cross were the only thing that you needed to believe in, then those who observed what happened on Passover would become immortal. But because there is a threshold that we still must cross to enter God's home, because while we are flawed, God is perfect. And so his children are therefore perfected. If you do not avail yourself of the next day, what happened on the Shabbat in 33 CE in Jerusalem, and if your soul is not cleansed of the fungus that is yeast, which is symbolic of sin, then you become immortal, but immortally separated from God, excluded from crossing that threshold and entering God's home. And so Christianity, as it is stated, which is to believe in the death of God on a cross and nothing more, that is the worst of all possible circumstances. Because if you become immortal and yet are separated from God, there's only one place that can house immortal spirits that are separated from God. And that's Sheol, which is known in the as a transliteration from the Greek as hell. And yet, if you were not to rely on the doorway of Passover and not to rely on unleavened bread, then your soul at the end of your mortal existence simply ceases to exist, which is not a penalty. Just you've got to live your life is over, and you're never going to see the doorway to heaven. And so it's one of the places where Christianity is completely errant. And of course, Christianity recognizes that there's a doorway. They associate Yahusha, although they don't know his name, being at the doorway, but they don't understand that the doorway is Passover. But be that as it may, we considered this passage specifically because we wanted to demonstrate that when Yah uses Shamayim, he's speaking of the spiritual realm, his home, which is in heaven. And so God is saying that he created the spiritual realm. He created his home, which he is inviting us to enter by way of his covenant in heaven. The seventh and final word of Scripture's first sentence, of the Torah's first sentence, is Eretz. It's wa Eretz, so it's and the material realm. Its primary definition describes a region, a realm, a land, or a territory. which in this passage could either be the material universe, but not our solar system, the earth, Eden, or the promised land of Israel, because these, it couldn't be those things, because they wouldn't come to exist for another 10 billion years. Eretz can also be rendered earth, as in the ground, the soil, the material things that comprise the abode and the very essence of mortal man. Eretz is the fourth most prevalent noun in the Torah, Prophets and Psalms, and is found an astonishing 2,500 times. And so when God uses the term Eretz, it has to be defined based upon the context of the sentence. In this case, it's the material realm. Some places, the land represents the promised land. It represents Yisrael, but Yisrael is also a metaphor for living with God, because Yisrael is where God materialized, where he himself came to earth to meet with us. It is the place that he asks us to camp out with him. It's the place that he will return when he returns in year 6000 Yah, 2033, on our pagan calendars. At the very heart of Eretz is the concept of natural material, especially as it relates to the minute physical particles of matter from which men, the earth, and the universe are comprised. Its root means to be firm. So Eretz, the primary root of Eretz, explains something that science wouldn't even come to approach for 3,500 years after this was dictated to Moshe. You see, the only difference between that which is spiritual, which is described by God as light, as energy, the only difference between energy and that which is matter is that matter is firm energy. It's energy in such a way is that it is more firm. Matter is simply organized energy. Matter is energy in such a way that it is manifest as being more firm. And so Eretz speaks of that firming of energy to create matter. And therefore it is associating it with that which is tangible and material as opposed to that which is energetic and spiritual. Therefore, in this passage, at this time, and in this context, the most obvious way to distinguish between Shamayim and Eretz, because God said that he created the Shamayim and the Eretz, the spiritual realm and the material realm, is the spiritual abode and that which is matter. It is important to remember that the first people who heard this message had no concept whatsoever of planet Earth, much less any idea of what stars represented. It is likely that they would have understood Eretz as the material world beneath their feet, as in the ground itself. And they would have seen the heavens as the opposite of that which they could touch, as the abode of God, and as the place they wanted to be welcomed at the end of their mortal life. So long as the divide between physical and spiritual, their perceptions would have been accurate and meaningful. And yet today, blessed as we are with a worldview, a universal view, and with a partial understanding of the cosmos, we can deduce a much bigger and much more profound sense from these words. In that way, Yahweh's word was as meaningful to people of that time as it is to us today. Now, bringing it all together, the first seven words reveal, in the beginning, the Almighty created and was alongside and closely associated with the spiritual world and the material realm. Now, I recognize that in English, I communicated vastly more than seven words. But in the Hebrew, because conjunctions and articles and prepositions are part of the nouns and verbs themselves, that it is just seven words. everything God does follows his plan of 6 plus 1 equals 7. And we're going to see that in this very Genesis account, that man who is created on the sixth day plus God who is one equals 7, which is God's promise to us. Everything God does, from the 7 Moed Mikre, the 7 invitations to be called out and meet with God, to the 7 lights that are part of his menorah, everything associated with God is based on this formula, as is the Sabbath itself, which is 6 days that we can work, and the 7th, we rest and reflect on our relationship with Yahweh. So in the beginning, at the start and the initiation of the process of existence, concerning the first fruits and the head of the family, the Almighty, he created, bara, conceived and produced, transformed, and was alongside and closely associated with the spiritual world and the material realm. Now, speaking of these things, let's take a moment to ponder the massiveness of our earthly spaceship and its universal intergalactic home. There is a reason for its enormous scale and energy in space and in time. It had to be precisely like it is for us to exist temporally as stardust transformed into life, and for us to have the option to choose greater dimensions, to be reborn in the spirit of light. Should any aspect of the material universe differ by so much as one part, in a million, or 1 in 10 to the 120th power, the ripple effect on every other aspect of existence would cause the universe to implode. In other words, God made the perfect calculation on how much of his spiritual energy to transform into matter, to create a universe that was hospitable, not only for our earth to exist, but for life on it to exist. And should he have introduced 1 in 10 to the 120th power, more or less energy, into his enormous variable calculation, the universe would have imploded upon itself. We would not exist, nor would any form of life. While this does not prove the role of a creator, it does demonstrate just how marvelously creation is tuned for universal existence and for life itself. Now we're going to continue to consider the preciseness to which this universe was designed when we return to Shattering Myths, based upon Yah's original story in his Torah, in just a moment. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering our galactic spaceship, this planet Earth, and the enormous universe in which it resides. In our present form, trapped in the flow of time, humankind will never visit another planet, much less leave our solar system. Three-dimensional mass cannot be accelerated to the speed of light, because the faster something moves, the greater its mass becomes. If an object were to reach the speed of light, its mass would become infinite, filling the entire universe. Further, to move an infinite mass would take an infinite amount of energy, more energy than there is in the universe. Thus, no material thing can ever attain the speed of light, leaving the universal distances far too great to navigate. Complicating this matter, not only is the preponderance of the known universe beyond our reach, but because the distance stars are moving away from us faster than the speed of light due to the stretching of space, even if we could travel at the speed of light, which is a physical impossibility, we still wouldn't be able to get there. Therefore, our only hope of exploring the universe is to become greater than we are and much more like our Creator. And when that happens, when we are empowered, as one of the benefits of the covenant, one of its 5 benefits is God says that he empowers us, which we become much more energetic than we are now. We cease to be a physical being. We can embark on this grand voyage. There are over 100 billion galaxies each averaging over 100 billion stars. Many, if not most, are replete with solar systems, with planets and moons. So when we are born anew in spirit and become like light and can travel through time, we will be able to explore the vastness and the brilliance of Yahweh's creative genius. Since Scripture tells us that we will one day become like God and be like light, we will enjoy the photon's perspective, where from its point of reference, while traveling enormous different distances, 186,282 miles per second, it appears to travel no distance at all and takes no time to do so. While the vast scale of our universe is instructive, suggesting the need for a designer and a creator, its minute scale is also thought-provoking. From our perspective, the substance of creation diminishes in scale equally rapidly and marvelously as it expands. The micro-realm is comprised of molecules, of atoms, of electrons, of quarks, retreating infinitely inward beyond our vision. This suggests that our internal investigations may one day be as limitless in all directions and dimensions. This is why even agnostic scientists are anthropomorphic-centric. That means that they recognize that man actually is in the center of the universe with regard to scale, and that the cosmos was tuned precisely for human existence. But why it was tuned for our existence and by whom is the question we are exploring by considering the Torah. The Torah's second sentence provides some clues. It is equally enlightening. It reads, "And the material realm, the eretz, the physical world, and the natural substance of which the universe was comprised, exist as a formless," this is tohu, "orderless and empty void," bohu, "and darkness," chosek, "was before the presence," pane, "of the Big Bang." So here we read that Tahom, the Big Bang, is the Hebrew word for great commotion from the inaccessible and mysterious depths. It is from whom that which is deeply anxious, agitated, perplexing, loud, and distracting. This is Bereshith, Genesis 1-2. This is insightful and so typical of Yahweh. Man came up with the concept of Big Bang after scientists realized that they had been wrong when they said that the universe had always existed. Hubble, when he detected the redshift, and therefore that stars were moving away from us at great speed, was able to deduce the fact that at one time the universe had a beginning. And so science in the 1950s changed, and 90% of scientists went from saying that the universe never was created, that it always existed, to saying that the universe was in fact created, and they called that creation the Big Bang. Well, they were a little late on the uptake with the terminology. You see, Yahweh, in 1450 BCE, almost 3,500 years ago, coined the term the Big Bang, Tahom. And what he said is that this great commotion came from an inaccessible and mysterious depth, something that science just in the last 10 years has come to recognize, that we can't see past the Big Bang as to what happened before it. It is the mystery to humankind. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering Yah's testimony as he begins his Genesis account, which is known in Hebrew as Bereshith, in the beginning. In the second statement of the Torah, God said, "And the material realm, the Eretz, existed as a formless tohu, orderless and empty void, bohu, and darkness, chosek, was before the presence, pane, of the Big Bang." To home. What God said we have just come to realize. Just in the last month or two, there have been confirmed indications that there is a residual microwave background radiation that precedes the Big Bang. That, not too long ago with the Wilkinson probe, the world discovered that the Big Bang occurred 13.5 billion years ago. But what scientists could never tell you is what happened before the Big Bang and how long that took. And what God is saying here is that there was the existence of things that were formless, orderless, empty, and dark that preceded the Big Bang. And I suspect that period was considerably longer than scientists are willing to acknowledge. It also conveys something that we have learned quite recently. Speaking of this not only empty void, this darkness, and this mysterious and inaccessible depths, scientists have recognized just recently that 96% of what comprises the universe is dark, is Kosek. It is to home. It is mysterious to us. And we have labeled 96% of what comprises the universe dark matter and dark energy. These are things that scientists cannot define. They don't know what they are. They know that one of them, dark matter, is attractive, and that dark energy is repulsive. Those are not pejorative statements. They just speak of what they do as a force. One propels, the other attracts. And that we not only don't know what they are, we have no method of even determining what 96% of the universe is comprised of. And that's what God told us here, that it would be a mystery to us. And it is. So this is a profound statement about the physical nature of the universe and its beginning, which God calls the Big Bang. Spiritually, though, he uses terms that also have a spiritual message. You see, he used tohu, bohu, and kochek, lifeless, orderless, and dark. Tohu is formless confusion, lifelessness, and nothingness. It is a ruinous and destructive chaos. It speaks of idolatry and worthless worship that emanates from false testimony. Bohu is a complete lack of order, a desolate and empty void. An abyss, which is where souls that choose to compete, to oppose Yahweh, will spend their eternity. To be Chosek is to be obscured in darkness, to be apart from God's light. Yahweh relates these things to Tohum, to the abyss, to the place of separation. Tohum is a deep, dark, and inaccessible place. And so it is the eternal resting place, if you will, not, although there won't be most rest, of HaSatan and his fellow demons and those who league with him. It's another profound spiritual insight in the midst of a precisely accurate explanation scientifically of a method that God used to commence what we now call the Big Bang, using his terminology. Of course, there is the science, to whom is derived from whom, which means a great movement and noise, which is exactly what the Big Bang was designed to convey. Great movement and noise. It is the direct definition of great explosion or Big Bang. So by using the term Big Bang, mankind's most acclaimed competitive alternative to the Bereth in the beginning Genesis account, Yahweh is demonstrating that he has a sense of humor. And while most Americans are aware of the Big Bang Theory, a proposition in which the universe is said to have started out 100 billion times smaller than the photon of light, it should be noted that according to MIT's 2002 Physics Annual, and I quote, the theory doesn't explain the Big Bang, but instead explains its aftermath, and only its aftermath, that period of time in which the universe expanded and cooled. The theory says nothing about the underlying physics of the primordial explosion and provides no clues about when the bang occurred, what caused it to bang, or what happened before it banged. The explosion theory gives no explanation for the razor-sharp fine-tuning of the universe, and thus does not describe a universe that resembles the one in which we live. End quote. Amazing, huh? I don't think there's one in a million people that recognize that MIT, in their physics annual, wrote this and acknowledged that rather than providing an answer, all science has done is use the term that God provided. And God himself said that there was a lack of order, a lack of physical laws, if you will, before the Big Bang. He told us exactly what these folks wrote in 2002. So what is purported to be science and thus is assumed to be testable and taught as fact is neither. The simple truth is, scientists still have more questions than answers, and even their conclusions are constantly changing. But don't accept my testimony on this. Consider P.J.E. Peebles' conclusion. He is the acknowledged leader in the field of universal beginnings, a professor of cosmology at Princeton University. He said, and I quote, "Cosmology, the study of beginnings, formation, and evolution of our universe, is currently in a badly confused state. At the moment, scientists do not know what makes up 99% of the universe. This, needless to say, is a rather embarrassing situation. Although much of what is visible in the universe is becoming comprehensible, with great recent strides in understanding star formation, galactic structure, and spectacular events such as supernovae, it would appear that there is another component of the universe, possibly making up most of its mass, which we cannot see and we do not understand." As a matter of fact, what he should have said is not possibly, but absolutely making up the majority, the preponderance of its mass and energy, which we cannot see and which we do not understand. But God made it clear to us what happened. Returning to someone who does understand, a slightly different but equally acceptable translation of Bereshith 1:2 reveals that while the scientific term dark matter is only a score of years old, Yahweh has always been familiar with the concept. The natural material existed formless, as in an orderless and empty void, obscured in darkness, along with the presence of the inaccessible and mysterious energy. If the scientific community only knew where to look, what to observe, long ago they would have come to recognize that God was explaining what happened, defining the very terms Big Bang, dark matter, dark energy, which astronomers and physicists would come to ponder, perhaps suggesting that they would never come to understand these mysteries. In these verses, Yahweh is introducing the concept of relationship and separation. We must choose which side of the divide we want to be on: darkness, confusion, and lifelessness, or light, instruction, and life; the family, or the void. It should therefore be no surprise that when that light, instruction, and life occupy Yahweh's thoughts over the next 3 days of creation, that he is telling us something. And that on the fourth day, he presents the ultimate guide to light, to instruction, and to life itself. While we're on the subject of God, and of him knowing that which man does not know, of God being light and of man stumbling in the darkness, the most recent tests conducted by the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe satellite experiments show that dark energy, a force completely unknown to man, occupies 73% of the universe, and that dark matter, the effect which is equally mysterious and inaccessible to man, represents 23% of universal content. We know these percentages because 73% of the matter in the universe is attractive, acting like gravity, causing galaxies to spin at rates that would not be possible unless we are completely unaware of what comprises 73% of the universe's mass. We are aware that 23% of the universe's total content has to be this dark energy, because the universe is not only expanding, when if it was not there, the universe expansion would be slowing and the universe would in fact be contracting now, but that not only is expanding, but that it is expanding at an accelerating rate. That means that at least 23% of what comprises the universe has to be repulsive in nature. It has to be energy that is causing this universe not only not to contract on itself, but to expand at an ever-increasing rate. So we can witness the consequence of these things without understanding what they're comprised. Therefore, our known and testable theories only account for 4% of the energy and matter that comprise the actual universe. All we know about dark matter is that it is both ubiquitous and repulsive, and that its relationship, or excuse me, that the dark matter is attractive, and the dark energy is repulsive. That's all we know. And that if these things were not present, the universe would not exist as it does and would not be hospitable to life. While it isn't pertinent to our discussion, should you be interested in the reason scientists know that a substance they call dark matter exists, is because of the very thing I just mentioned, is that spiral galaxies are spinning 10 times faster than the laws of physics specify based upon the gravitational effect of the observed mass. And the reason that we know that something scientists refer to as dark energy exists, as I shared just a moment ago, is because the universe expansion is accelerating. If it were not for these unknown sources of enormous energy, the cumulative effect of gravity would slow and then contract the universe, the opposite of what we are observing. Further, dark is not pejorative. It simply means that we're unable to see it, much less understand these things. They are, as God said, inaccessible and a mystery to us. Back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. We will be continuing this discussion on our program tomorrow. But before we advance further into Yahweh's testimony, let's establish a more complete foundation so that we can appreciate what God has to say. In that regard, it's important to recognize that how God created the universe was well beyond the vocabulary and the comprehension of his initial audience. The language of astronomy, of physics, and of calculus, the matrix of space-time and of relativity, the equivalency of energy and matter, and the language of life, DNA, would not come to be understood for another 3,500 years. Without them, it was absolutely impossible to explain how the universe and life were conceived. Even with these advances, mankind's quest to comprehend our existence remains both clouded and unfulfilled. Therefore, for the creation accounts to be relevant for all people in all ages, and for there to be something all generations could understand and apply regardless of their time or circumstances, there must be storylines other than just how. And so there are. But sadly, these themes are not commonly known. And what's even more egregious is that what is taught is usually wrong. Fortunately, today we are in a position to appreciate the significance of each of the three messages that Yahweh was conveying. For example, in the last 30 years, scientists have discovered that Yahweh was right regarding every important aspect of the beginning of the universe and of life. The cosmos had a genesis, contrary to what most astronomers believed in the middle part of the 20th century. The universe began with an enormous, practically infinite concentration of energy in a singular place and time, a Big Bang, consistent with Yahweh's declaration and terminology. Light was, in fact, the first thing that came to exist. This energy would eventually coalesce to form matter, and we even find that the universe is stretched out and consists of space-time, again, harmonious with Yahweh's accounting. Plants preceded animals, and such simple life forms emerged from the sea the moment liquid water came to exist on the earth, consistent with Yahweh's assertions, but not with Darwin's. Plants and animals are both comprised of elements of the earth, and they literally exploded onto the scene in separate eras in absolute accordance with Yah's Torah testimony. The fossil evidence confirms that there were no gradual mutations from simple to complex life forms, nor was there an evolutionary tree between phyla, the basic categories of life. As we shall discover, Yahweh's witness is accurate. Representatives of each of the 34 animal phylum alive today were actually present in the fossils of the Cambrian period. They all came to exist, reproduced after their kind, and flourished in their complex form within a cosmic nanosecond of less than 5 million years. Insects and fish, vertebrates and invertebrates, complex bone structures, and the most sophisticated internal organs, even male and female forms, all appeared simultaneously in one enormous explosion of life. Precisely as Yahweh described it, and in complete accord, or discord, I should say, with macroevolutionary theory. In fact, it is microevolutionary theory which is errant. Not only do harmful mutations, which destroy information, outnumber beneficial ones by a million to one in the genome, in the genetic structure, including chromosomes, genes, and nucleotides, natural selection, acting on the phenome, the entire body, rather than the genome, is unable to keep pace, meaning that every animal species is degenerating over time, not evolving to become more complex, more sophisticated organisms. Further, no scientist, has been able to demonstrate that any animal gene mutation has actually added a meaningful amount of new information. And while some random mutations have been beneficial, they are insignificant in quantity compared to destructive changes, and they are irrelevant in the comparison or by comparison to the vast differences between species. Now, we're going to return to this subject, which forms the foundation of the scientific mindset and of secular humanism, and we will discuss it as we move forward into subsequent chapters of Yah's Torah. Yahweh's 3,000-year-old creation account, barring three potential and very revealing exceptions, is completely consistent with the evidence mankind has most recently discovered. And yet, while that's true, one-year-old high school and college textbooks, while still clinging to the notions that modern scientists have since disproved, are errant. In fact, science would be advanced in schools if the Torah were understood and taught. We'll return to this subject tomorrow on Shattering Myths.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects